Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week, giving you a chance to catch up, ponder, or reconsider. On Monday, February 15th, Alan and Joe spoke with investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and former associate editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
And of course, the big news is the acquittal of Donald Trump in his second, yes, second, impeachment trial, acquitted, and as the Washington Post put it, he got off on a technicality. The technicality being that even those who said that the president was largely responsible for what happened at the Capitol on January 6th, he was not. It was not a constitutional trial because it did not happen. This is what Mitch McConnell said. It did not happen. The trial did not happen when he was president. But if it would have happened, even though he kept it from happening, then he would have been. Can you figure the logic out on that one?
Yeah, the logic was survival. That's what it was.
Wow. So on Saturday, Trump was acquitted at a second impeachment trial, largely, if not completely, on a technicality, the argument that the trial itself was unconstitutional. The vote, while an acquittal, represented a historic rebuke. Seven GOP senators voted to convict. Previously, one senator from a president's party had ever voted to convict, seven in this case. So the final vote, 57-43, that meant Trump was 10 votes from the 67 that would have resulted in his conviction. Yes, that is still a long way away, but if you look closely at what the 43 Republicans who voted to acquit said about it, it seems possible, but for the unconstitutionality claims, Trump might have come quite a bit closer, losing on the merits. At least five Republican senators suggested that Trump was indeed culpable for the Capitol riots while voting to acquit him on constitutional grounds. As I mentioned, that includes Mitch McConnell, John Thune, Senator Shelley Moore Capito, Senator Dan Sullivan of Alaska, and Senator Rob Portman of Ohio. All right, Alan, let's begin with that.
It is, of course, disgusting. I mean, there were people who I know personally who, you know, really had a rough day because they really thought that the Republicans in the United States Senate, who had their hands on the Constitution and the Bible and swore their allegiance to truth and everything, would come around because they had
truth, justice, and the American way.
Yeah,
yes.
And they would come around and they would do what they had to do. Of course, I had no such expectation, knowing who and what they and their followers are like. The Republicans who switched over and who came over to the right side, they've already been censored and they're going to be censured in the future for doing what they did, which was courageous, profiles in courage, and terrific. Now, Mitch McConnell has certain derision. You know, the argument here is you can do anything you want while you're president because we're going to protect you. And you can't do anything after you, president, which is going to hold you politically responsible because you're not president anymore. It really is enough to take, you know, your breath away. It is so awful. And I can only say that for all of those people out there who won't forget this, good for you.
Rosemary Armeo.
Well, I think lawyers in this country should be ashamed of their profession. Trump had the worst defense, completely talentless hack who had no case, who resorted to lies and misrepresentation, and he still won. That there's something wrong. And I think that we are in a huge muddle for reasons that Alan began to get into, the seven who voted the way that case should have been decided, are being punished, censored. And Burr, who I don't know how courageous it was, he's not running again. He didn't have to answer to anybody. But his seat now, one of the contenders is Laura Trump, Donald daughter-in-law, who's a little one of his minions, and his people will be out in force to protect her. We're far from over the trouble that Donald Trump has caused. Now, on the other hand, is what do Democrats do from here? And I take back everything I've ever said about Biden living up to unity and bipartisanship. It's clear that he needs to pass voting rights immediately so that when we do come to a contest between Democrats and Republicans, Democrats have an easier hand. He needs to start working on gerrymandering for the same reason. He needs to get through COVID aid and forget trying to get them to sign on. I'm done with it. I think that the Mitch McConnell speech, which was a speech for conviction coming after he acquitted him, was, I mean, we've remarked before about his hypocrisy, but nothing ever will beat that. And we just take it? No. It's time to now take off the gloves and start playing with them. And one last thought. I've been watching the trouble that Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo, is in trouble here. He has made a mistake. And have Democrats pulled away from criticizing him, from calling him out? No. The Democrats hold their own people to a higher standard, and the Republicans don't. And that is a problem. And we have to do something about it as Democrats. That's it.
What? Libby Post.
Well, I, you know, there's not a lot more to say. I mean, Mitch McConnell, I was screaming at the television. You know, Mitch McConnell's speech afterwards was a profile in cowardice, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, he laid out all the reasons to convict, and yet they hang up on a technicality, which the most conservative of legal scholars say was not a technicality.
Well, a technicality also that they themselves created. The technicality,
right,
saying,
right,
that, you know, he could have, that could have happened while he was in office.
That's,
but,
right,
they wouldn't allow it. So,
right, for him to say, oh, we should have, this could have happened if he was still president, but yet McConnell was very clear he wasn't going to let it happen. It's just, you know, so duplicitous. The problem is, what we need really now is to clone Stacey Abrams and to have her and her forces go into some of these states where there are minority majority in terms of population, and get folks registered and get them empowered and get them to vote some of these people out. I mean, you know, we all thought Amy McGrath had a shot at beating McConnell, and she didn't. You know, we saw time and time again. And so we just need to be strategic. And what this does, though, is free up the White House, free up the Biden administration. We're now past this, and he can get down to business, and the Congress can get that down to business of passing what needs to be passed, but also approving an attorney general, getting the rest of the cabinet filled, and just moving forward. And it was interesting because McConnell said, this is a case for the Department of Justice, which means, I mean, in my book, which makes a signal, sends a signal that they're going to approve Merrick Garland. And because this is going to be an opportunity for McConnell to raise money. All that speech was a fundraising speech to the big pocketed donors who couldn't stand Trump, but still like the Republicans, still like McConnell's politics. And just to let them all know he's still in charge in a way, and that, you know, I think they're going to saddle the Democrats and the Department of Justice with this, and that it'll be an overall negative for the administration.
Mike Spain?
Yeah, I think that the battle is underway for control of the Republican Party. You have the Washington Republicans like McConnell. And you have, you know, the insurgents, you know, like Ted Cruz or Josh Hawley or even, you know, Lindsey Graham, who's all over the place, but currently he's with Trump again. And you have McConnell and kind of the establishment Republicans. And they're worried, of course, that the base is going to, you know, back Trump. But it's good for the Democrats if they want to get their programs through. I think they can. They have the votes to do it themselves, and they're probably just going to go ahead and do it while the Republicans kind of battle for control and soul of the party. And, you know, this stuff all plays out pretty quickly, and it's gonna heat up if Trump does start doing interviews and starts showing up at rallies and doing, speaking tours across the country. And we'll know pretty soon how effective he's going to be if Laura Trump decides to run in her home state of North Carolina. North Carolina, you know, it's like Georgia. It goes even more than Georgia. It goes both ways. You know, it's a purple state, and it could backfire or it could catch fire. But in the meantime, the Democrats have that one dilemma that I think McConnell is an astute politician, handing it to the Democratic Justice Department, you know, under a Democratic president, and saying it's up to them to go after Trump. It can pull them in to the briar patch, you know what I mean? It can pull them into it and bog down the Biden administration with, you know, holding Trump accountable. And I suppose we'll talk about it. I think the answer is to sort of get an independent commission, bipartisan commission, to take a deep breath, step back, and look at everything that led up to January 6th and all before it, and recommend ways to go forward.
Yeah, I do want to talk about that, Joe, as well. Alan?
Joe, if I may, I wanted to react to something that the wonderful Rosemary said. She talked about voting rights. She's certainly right about that. This is a great time. All three institutions, Democratic, pass it now. And there's no way out of that. But she also said the gerrymander. Well, Felix Frankfurter started it all in the Supreme Court, and they're still talking about it, which is we don't get involved in the political thicket. So in that one, you'd have to get through the Supreme Court also. But boy, the gerrymander is responsible for all kinds of chaos in this country.
Alan Chartok on the Roundtable panel on Monday, February 15th. This is Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. I'm producer Sarah LaDuke. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. For Tuesday's show, Alan and Joe were again joined by Rosemary Armeo and Mike Spain, and by Cajos City Director of Operations Teresa Bourgeois. For the portion of the program we're going to hear now, the guest is immunology and allergy specialist Dr. James Fagan.
Jim, how come the numbers are going down? That's the question I think an awful lot of people want to know.
Well, I think the numbers are going down for hopefully a couple of reasons. One, the vaccinations are, you know, we've now vaccinated over 52 million vaccines have been administered in the United States, and it's beginning to have an impact. I mean, you know, the goal for herd immunity was to vaccinate as many people as possible. So I think the vaccinations are definitely having an impact. And hopefully people are also adhering to mitigation strategies that have been proposed.
So when it comes to vaccinations, let us talk about that for a moment and where that stands, because while we see the numbers going down, and yes, that is good news, and we hear about some people who are being vaccinated, it is still really, really hard for someone to get an appointment to get a vaccine. So, and I realize since we broadcast to so many states that it differs from where you are, but let's look at New York first as an example, because New York is in phase 1B, which up until yesterday did not include those with comorbidities. It does now. I think the number I read was an additional 4 to 5 million people, right? That puts into the pool who are now trying to get an appointment. But the key to this is we haven't seen the number of vaccines increase any as far as what state and local governments are getting to give to people. So you're adding to the pool, but you still have the same number of vaccines.
Yeah, and that's the real problem, is that, number one, we don't have enough vaccines available to vaccinate, you know, the 300 million people in the United States we want to vaccinate. Number two is it hasn't been, the organization is not the best either in terms of, you know, setting up vaccination centers and how and notifying everyone. How, you know, people are, I hear this, you know, just like you said, people are on the online all day long trying to figure out where, you know, can I get vaccinated? And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, they discover that, you know, there's a new site that just set up for a day or two, and everyone sort of, you know, focuses on that. And it's just it's impossible. So we need to, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in order to actually administer the vaccines in the appropriate way. I know that Pfizer and Moderna both committed to adding 100 million doses each, which will give us, I think, a total of around 400 million doses between those two companies, which, you know, which will definitely help. And then, you know, there's the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which hopefully will get emergency use approval, you know, fairly soon. So, you know, hopefully we'll get more vaccines available, but that isn't going to, you know, address the problem of how do people then go about getting the vaccines, you know, who do they call, and you know, what happens to all the people who don't have access to, you know, to computers and who have difficulty going online? What do they do? So we have a lot of work to do.
I get so confused because you hear these things and you wonder, just I say, well, why weren't they doing that to begin with? So yesterday or the day before was the news that Moderna said, now, well, now we can, we've been authorized, we can put more of the vaccine into a vial so we can get more shots out of it. Okay, but why didn't they just do that? Like, why?
Yeah, I think
or get a bigger bottle. Like I don't quite understand that.
Well, you know, it's not like you know, getting you know, apple juice and just drinking it. The vaccines are tightly regulated, and for good reason, you know. And right. That includes the number of doses that can be administered in a vial, what's the maximum dilution that you can put into, you know, and so all of these things are closely regulated. And, you know, and every change, the companies have to do some investigation and then submit their data and just convince the regulating agencies that, you know, this is safe to do. You know, I certainly agree with you. I mean, it seems sort of ridiculous that they just couldn't add a few more doses. And in fact, they were getting that from the Moderna. They were sort of squeezing an extra dose, you know, out of the vial anyway. And so, but you know, hopefully these issues will be addressed.
And I guess it makes sense when you're doing everything so quickly that you sort of realize these problems as you go along, and it's inevitable that it's going to happen. Alan, go ahead.
Well, what do you want me to ask?
Oh, I thought you were going to, I thought you had a question. I apologize.
No, but I always have a question for the amazing Dr. Fagan.
And, yes.
And one of them is, obviously, how do you get to those people who you have just announced can't get the stuff? In other words, they don't speak the language. They may not even be citizens. They certainly don't have a computer. What's the strategy?
I think it's got to be community-based, Alan. I really do. I think that the community, whether it's places of worship or community centers where they can, or just setting up, you know, tented areas and getting the word out into the community and having people in the community who can assist those individuals who have a tough time, you know, sort of following what they need, the rules in terms of what they need to do. I think one of the biggest problems has been, and I've seen this in especially in some of the elderly members of the community who, they may not have access to computers. Some of them have smartphones, some of them don't. If they have smartphones, they may not be exactly sure, you know, what needs to be done because information has to be transmitted in order to, you know, schedule an appointment. And so I think all of these issues have to be worked out. And I think that the best way to do this is, you know, through the community, at the community level.
I want to go to Mike Spain for a question for you. I also just before that want to remind folks that we will take your questions for Dr. Fagan. You can write to us, panel at WAMC.org. We have quite a few already. Panel at WAMC.org, and we'll go to those in just a moment. Mike Spain.
Yeah, Doctor, I wondered, you probably get this question all the time. I hear it being asked a lot. When people do finally get their second shot, or if it's Johnson & Johnson, their shot, and the period of waiting goes by, you know, when can they hug their grandchildren, or when can you feel comfortable going out to indoor dining, things like that? Any cautious advice you might offer?
Yeah, so here's the deal with that. When you get your second immunization, you have to wait at least 10 to 14 days. We would say 2 weeks before that vaccination changes your immune responsiveness. So you go more to a memory type of cell-mediated immune response, which is really what you want. And it takes, you know, you don't get the shot and walk out of there saying, oh, I can do whatever I want right now. You still have to wait 10 to 14 days. After that 10 to 14 day period, you know, the real problem in answering your question is that what the clinical trials focused on was the prevention of moderate to severe disease and death from COVID-19. They didn't really focus on the question, well, can you still get asymptomatic or an infection of a very low severity? And that's important, because if you can still get an infection, then you can still pass that infection on to somebody else. The overwhelming likelihood, in my opinion, is that if you're fully immunized and you wait that 10 to 14 days, it would be extremely unlikely that you're going to contract, you know, COVID anytime in the near future. And if you don't contract an infection, you can't give it to anybody. And so I think after 14 days, I would have no problem at all in people going back to not completely normal way of life, but certainly grandparents visiting, you know, their kids and their grandkids, and without masks and sort of doing away with the social distancing and the hugging and stuff would be fine. It would be extremely unlikely that grandparents would contract COVID from a grandchild if the grandparents were fully immunized. It would be almost impossible for them to transmit the disease to their family members. And so I think that after the second vaccine, after 2 weeks, you should feel very, very comfortable. Now, does that mean you don't have to wear a mask outside? No, you need to maintain that, at least for a while until we achieve herd immunity.
Dr. Jim Fagan on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, February 16th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel the week in review after this. Welcome back to Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuc. In addition to Alan Shartok and Joe Donahue, Wednesday's panelists were Rosemary Armeo, Times Union columnist Chris Churchill, and Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin.
Well, I wanted to start talking about the Texas power grid and what's happening there and the questions that has brought up. And I'm interested in, Bob, I know this is part of your expertise as to how these things work, but, you know, why is this such a problem? I mean, we don't expect it to get that cold in Texas, but here we go. And now the entire, almost, you know, much of the state is having a really horrible problem.
Yeah, and there's a couple twists to the Texas story. The first twist is that the Texas electric grid, unlike all of the other states, I think with the exception of Hawaii and Alaska, are interconnected. So that means that New York's grid is connected to Pennsylvania and Massachusetts and Vermont. So there's this idea that there's the redundancies built into the system. Texas is not built that way. It is a standalone system. What you're seeing is a couple of things. One is the overall vulnerability of our critical infrastructure. And this is something that I've been hoping from the prior administration, I'm hoping now from the Biden administration, that the federal government actually puts some serious money into our critical infrastructure. And part of that is absolutely the electric grid. The other piece of this, and I think this is maybe part of the more interesting conversation to have today, is that, you know, this is the market at work. You know, Texas prides itself on sort of this, you know, they beat their chest about how independent, and they brag about how strong they are. And of course, until they have a problem, and then the rest of us have to bail them out. And if you're sitting at home saying, oh, no, that's not the case, I just point you to Ted Cruz's tweet last year about California, right, where, you know, when California was going through those horrible fires and the issues with their electric grid, he said, quote, California is now unable to perform the basic functions of civilization. Well, there's two lessons here. One is that you shouldn't tweet about somebody else's misfortune because you're calling it on yourself. And the second is that this is a reflection of deregulation, Joe, that there wasn't enough regulation, I believe, in place in order to assure that the electric providers were putting money back into the critical infrastructure. It was more about taking profits out than it was making sure that the system was good.
It is interesting. I mean, obviously, you look at the political ramifications coming from Texas, and the Texas political scene is much different, as you point out, than the California political scene, obviously. But huge winter storms plunge large parts of the central and southern United States into an energy crisis this week, with frigid blasts of Arctic weather crippling electric grids and leaving millions of Americans without power amid dangerously cold temperatures. The grid failures were most severe in Texas, where more than 4 million people woke up on Tuesday morning to rolling blackouts. Separate regional grids in the Southwest and Midwest also face serious strain. As of Tuesday afternoon, at least 23 people nationwide had died in the storm and its aftermath. Analysts have begun to identify key factors behind the grid failures in Texas. Record-breaking cold weather spurred residents to crank up their electric heaters and push power demand beyond the worst-case scenarios that grid operators had planned for. Chris Churchill.
Well, I know we want to blame politics for everything, but the fact that we see these kind of blackouts in almost all parts of the country suggests to me that it's not just about politics, right? I mean, sometimes there are just weather events that cause unexpected outcomes. And we've had ice storms here in the Albany area that have knocked out power for people for days and days. And it doesn't surprise me at all that an ice event in Texas would do the same thing. That said, it does get fairly cold in Texas, not, you know, at least once or twice a winter. I've lived in Texas. It depends on what part of the state you're in, but it does get fairly cold at times. And it does seem like the state should be a little bit better prepared for cold weather when it does come.
And it's, you know, it's like when a southern state gets snow. I mean, they don't have plows because they're just not expecting it. So, but this does seem to be different. Alan, your thoughts on this?
Well, I think Chris is right on the money. It's preparation. You know, politics has destroyed a lot of people who were not and weather has, who have not been where they should be and what they're doing, what they can, or who are perfectly blameless but still get the blame. We have seen that happen, and so now we have mayor in Texas who resigns, suggesting that you know, the people were stupid for not having taken care of each other and that they're whiners. You know, I mean, look, the mark of a politician is being able to respond to crisis and respond well. I think that's why Cuomo got his high creds and why, to some degree, he's in a little bit of trouble right now, but not that much. I truly believe it's all about being able to react to circumstances. They throw a ball at your head and you either know how to deflect it or not.
Rosemary.
Okay, so I want to blame politicians and big corporations because they're all complicit in this. First, Texas, the biggest supplier of natural gas in the country, runs out of natural gas. This if nothing else is bad planning. It's that right there. They did, as Bob said, plan not for weather this bad. They gambled that it would never get this bad, and so there's no other mechanism set up to protect. It's all set up to sell off all the natural gas and to keep prices as low as possible and profits as high. And it is not unique to Texas, although it's particularly egregious there. We also saw it in California with the utility that had such bad infrastructure that it contributed to forest fires, to wildfires last year. So they're totally complicit. The second thing are the freaking lying politicians who are now saying it was frozen wind turbines that caused it.
Yeah.
Wind provides 10% of the power in Texas. It is not the major cause at all. And they're also saying, oh, we need deregulation. No, we don't. Deregulation is what it gets you, is that you're not prepared for emergencies. If you're not prepared for sharing, if this were happening and it was part of the grid like the other states, it would have been regulated. And in an emergency like this, Texans would have gotten energy supplies from surrounding states and would be just fine right now. So this is they should be blaming two people first. Wait, one more thing. I'm hearing politicians led by the Texans, the idiots, talking about how this proves what a bad deal the Green New Deal would be because it would invest in alternative power. And so that's what's failing right now. So they're lying and their greed has caused this problem. And there's plenty of blame. This is not just a snowstorm in New York. Siberia doesn't run out of electricity. Norway doesn't run out of electricity. Why is Texas? We're turning into a third world country.
It's hard to gaslight everybody when you have no gas, isn't it?
Dan Crenshaw, the representative from Texas, has been tweeting wildly on this and making many of the points that Rosemary has said that are on the other side. This is what happens when you force the grid to rely in part on wind as a power source. When weather conditions get bad, as they did this week, intermittent renewable energy like wind isn't there when you need it. I think in a span of about 20 minutes, he texted or he tweeted about 40 times on this issue. I'm joining my Texas colleagues and getting to the bottom of what happened. We can do better. This is a once-in-a-century event. I don't know that we know that. It's a once-in-a-century weather event. California has constant energy problems and high prices. The reason for blackouts is complex, but in summary, Texas took too many lessons from Cali over subsidized renewables and pushed out baseload energy like natural gas. The conservative guide to the culture wars, in no particular order, America is worthy of our love and patriotism. Victor mentality is better than a victim mentality. Free speech is absolute. Hate speech is not an objective term. Okay.
Well, the one thing he said there that's definitely true is that it's like the power outages are a complex issue. And I do think there's a danger of oversimplifying and just blaming one thing or another. It is true that some of the wind turbines froze. It's also true that a lot of the natural gas generators froze. They just don't build, and maybe they should, but they just haven't built things in Texas to be prepared for ice storms like that or for that kind of cold weather. And things will go wrong sometimes. I mean, obviously Texas needs to improve its system. But, you know, in some ways, Texas deserves credit. 10% of your power coming from wind is pretty high for this country. I mean, Texas is way ahead of the game in a lot of these areas.
Yeah.
They're much more reliant on natural gas than a lot of the rest of the country, where coal is still an important factor. And coal is actually easier in these sorts of situations because it's easier to store. I mean, this is a really complex issue. And to just, you know, point out a few tweets from a few dumb politicians and just, you know, make it a red versus blue issue.
Okay, I can counter that. Yes, it is. I can counter this, Chris. Yes, it is indeed a very complex issue. That's my cuckoo.
Perfect timing. Did you pay for that, Chris? That could have been better.
Yeah, I think clock agrees with me.
Go ahead.
And you're both cuckoo. you're talking about the people who their living, their job is to look at these complex issues and to plan out systems. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem is all along they are denying climate. They're denying climate change in Texas. So, of course, they're unprepared and cooperative. Is it a surprise that it's getting colder in Texas? Well, it isn't to most of us who believe in climate change, but it appears to be to utility planners, both first now in California and now in Texas. And we have a wake-up call, and we're not seeing any evidence that they're moving to make. If they came out and said, oh, we had a really bad event, but here's how we know it isn't going to happen ever again because here's what we've done, I would say, yeah, you might have a point. But you don't, because they haven't. They're just saying, oh, this hardly ever happens. It's an act of nature. We can't do anything about it. That's their very job, is to do something about it.
On the Roundtable Panel on Wednesday, February 17th. This is Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm producer Sarah LaDuke. On Thursday, February 18th, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue spoke with Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Peabody and Emmy Award-winning journalist Linda Ellerby, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld, and Tetherless World Professor of Computer Web and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler.
So I'm going to start with the Cuomo story because it has something to do with what we were talking about as far as... Well, obviously, COVID and the state's response to it. So now legislators are moving to strip him of pandemic powers, and they are challenging the governor, Democrats challenging the governor in his handling of virus-related nursing home deaths. And the governor also faces now, we learned late yesterday from our friends of the Times Union, a federal inquiry into what's going on. The move comes as it emerged that the FBI and the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York has opened an inquiry into the Cuomo administration's handling of nursing homes during the pandemic. It was not known whether the inquiry, which was confirmed by three people familiar with the matter, was focused on Mr. Cuomo or any individual, only that it was in its earliest stages. The inquiry was another clear indication of how the climate has shifted dramatically for Governor Cuomo since March, when he emerged as a prominent voice in the health crisis, using his daily briefings and invocations of his family to inform in combination of viewers who turned to him as the virus began to spread. Now, much of that goodwill has evaporated. Then we get into the other story when he's now in a fight with Assemblyman Ron Kim, a Queens Democrat. This spilled out into the public yesterday as Governor Cuomo singled out Assemblyman Kim, who had said the governor had threatened him last week, an accusation that the governor's staff was a lie. Earlier this week, a group of Assembly Democrats, including Mr. Kim, circulated a letter among colleagues seeking support for the revoke of Mr. Cuomo's powers that suggested the administration had broken federal law, an accusation the governor stridently denied on Wednesday and went on to say that his fight with Assemblyman Kim is a long one. It goes back many years, and also went into some detail as to some of the misdeeds that Assemblyman Kim allegedly did several years ago. So it's getting messy, Alan.
I knew you were going to call on me today first. You know, yesterday I wasn't good enough to call on first. But today, because it's Cuomo,
I called on you first almost all the time.
Yeah, that's right. Not yesterday. And I keep track of these things. Like,
really?
Like Cuomo,
I'm sorry.
like Cuomo keeps track of things.
Yeah.
Okay, I got a couple of things to say here, Joe. We all love you, and you know that. Much of the goodwill you read in that story, it was from the Times or the Washington Post, has been dissipated. I don't think so. So far, we still see huge positive ratings for the governor. last time it came out, which was the Siena poll, and that was before a lot of this happened, you got 55%, which is humongous in politics. You had a president, a past president, who's left us now for a while, who has who never got above 50%. So that 55% was something. Secondly, comes this message from Kim and others about powers. I find that fascinating, you know, because here's why. The legislators themselves couldn't wait to give Cuomo the powers he wanted or that he needed because they wanted to stay home and be safe. Now that things are letting up a little, all of a sudden they're saying he grabbed these powers and we have to take them back. No, you gave him those powers, and you gave him those powers willingly and because you were concerned about yourselves. So I want to say that. And then a word to Andrew. Okay, Andrew, I'm not your advisor. And in fact, you haven't come around for an interview for a long time. And so I have no good reason to say anything good about you. However, I have a good idea for you. Keep your mouth shut. Don't start fooling with people like Kim. What do? You raise them, you elevate them, and you make yourself look petty. Don't do it. You know, you're the governor. You've got you were given high grades for the way you handled all of this in the beginning, at least. So just shut up. That's all I have to say. Is that enough?
That's enough. Ira Fussfeld.
Well, you know, as long as I've been reading and watching and talking to politicians, it never ceases to amaze me how the line about the cover-up is worse than the crime comes to the fore. I mean, this is a self-inflicted wound. I think that there are people in the state in the legislature, both parties, who have been waiting for Cuomo to trip up like this, and now they're going after him. The bullying tactics of Cuomo are not new, and I suspect those, you know, there've been ill will harbored for many years. But it just stuns me how this has come to be what it is, because it didn't have to be. If he had reported the numbers correctly from the outset, who would have blamed him? But, you know, the COVID was a scourge, is a scourge. And, you know, to feel the need to cover up the numbers, even if you're reporting the overall death numbers correctly, is just a silly misstep. That's all I can. It's probably a stronger word, but I'll go with silly misstep.
But you know what, Ira, you're exactly right. He shouldn't have done it. He should have just done what he did in the beginning. That's why he got all the high marks, in contrast to what Trump was doing. He told the truth about everything, no matter how uncomfortable. And you are absolutely right. This was silly.
Jim Hendler.
So, you know, I think Ira is right. Boy, we're all agreeing today. But, you know, the one thing I almost feel like Chris Churchill must have felt yesterday defending Texas. You know, let's not forget, though, that New York has come through this so much better than so many other states, where the governors refuse to believe in science, rush to open, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we had a bad spot at the beginning that put us up front, but we've done amazingly well comparatively since then. And it's just frustrating to see Cuomo, you know, shooting himself in the foot and then getting this, you know, circular firing squad, as Alan often refers to it, of, you know, in the Democrats in New York. We're going to, you know, give stuff back to the Republicans this way. And I don't know what'll happen, but, you know, it really seems like just a self-inflicted wound, and I'll just stop there.
Malia, what do you make of this? We have about a minute and a half.
Well, I think extraordinary powers are necessary in some situations, but they should always be used very sparingly. So even if Cuomo hadn't made a misstep, and I'm sympathetic to the difficulties of, you know, counting complicated statistics in a pandemic, but nonetheless, it's obviously a misstep. But even if he hadn't made a misstep, I think it would be time to be looking at whether these powers needed to be curtailed.
I basically agree with Ira and Alan on this one about Cuomo. I think it was a foolish mistake. I think the man has tried very hard and overall has done a tough and good job for the state of New York. I do not think that has happened with Charlie Baker in Massachusetts.
Linda Ellerbe on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, February 18th. Please note as you listen, any given topic's details may have changed as these items were discussed live earlier this week. This is Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, and we'll be back with a bit from Friday's show after this. Welcome back to Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Friday, January 19th, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue were joined by President and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Bruschetti, former EPA Regional Administrator Visiting Professor at Bennington College and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, and Albany County District Attorney, David Soares.
We've been talking about the Texas power grid and will continue to do so. We do have a couple of letters on it. Mo says, I'm wondering why, if the Texas power grid is a standalone and does not have to abide by national regulations, how are they eligible for FEMA funds?
Well, every state and every city is eligible for FEMA funds. And just because the political leadership is not responsible and well-informed, that's not a reason not to provide federal support for people who are suffering in crises like this.
We got this from Mary, who says, where is the state response and federal response to the emergency in Texas? People are dying just like the Katrina response. Is the state National Guard helping Houston? Is the federal government involved in the emergency?
I believe the Biden administration has sent over close to 60 industrial generators that really, you know, can make a significant difference, in addition to, I forget the exact number of fuel, but they've sent both. Apparently those are sitting in Fort Worth in some warehouse ready to be distributed. So it's going to be interesting to see what Governor Abbott, what he does in terms of preparing for the distribution of what the government has already thus far discharged.
I think you're right, David. I think that they did declare, Biden immediately declared an emergency down there. So, you know, the idea that somebody is putting out that, you know, Biden hasn't reacted to this is just fallacious.
I want to go back. Chris writes and says, Judith, explain in detail how this cold snap is related to climate, to global warming, and how any action on the part of humanity on the planet currently could have prevented it.
Thank you. I've been wanting to get to this for since the beginning of the show. And I did.
So did you write
letter.
As Chris? Okay,
I'm
all right.
Chris. All right. I'm not Chris. So the Arctic is heating up due to greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. That is pushing the really cold weather, the polar vortex, to other parts of the globe. And so Texas and other states, not just Texas, had that, you know, it's charitably called a cold snap. Well, it was Arctic cold air that moved out of the Arctic and hit Texas and other states. And this is an example of extreme weather. The Arctic heats up, the polar vortex is on the move. Texas will have this extreme weather many times in the future. So what do you do? Well, obviously, we need to dramatically drive down greenhouse gas emissions for the long-term solution, but in the interim, you can't have the people of Texas going through this next year and the following year. So you need to have emergency action to weatherize the grid. Think about, you know, maybe connecting with other states. This is how grids are managed. Power plants go down, you wheel in power from other states. So this extreme weather is our new reality, whether it's Arctic cold hitting Texas, or it's wildfires in the West, or it's hurricanes in New York and Puerto Rico. This is the face of climate change. So when the United Nations said we only had 10 years to avoid catastrophic impacts of climate change, I kind of disagree with that. I think catastrophic climate change is here. We've already seen what's phrased climate refugees. You know, people left New Orleans after Katrina. Many went to Texas. Puerto Rico is still reeling from the impacts of Hurricane Maria, and tremendous suffering in Texas, which I think the national media is just starting to scratch the surface on how big an issue this is and the unfortunate suffering. And thank goodness the lights are coming back on, but you have this water crisis, which is going to be followed by a real problem with mold infestations in all of these homes and businesses that were flooded. This is a multi-billion dollar economic hit in Texas. And so people who say we can't afford not to address climate change, well, the economics on this alone is immense.
Alan?
Can I add on to that a little bit?
Because, sure, absolutely.
I think an important thing that has sort of the media hasn't focused. So there's been a lot of finger pointing at ERCOT, which is basically the grid manager. And ERCOT, the reason that they did not have the kind of damage that would have put them in a position of having the grid go down for 3 months or 4 months is because they did implement rolling blackouts, which mm-hmm. by shedding load, they're able to prevent really sustained long-term damage to the actual infrastructure of the grid, which is the poles and the wires and, you know, transformer facilities and that, those kinds of things, which take a long time to actually repair. But what it all, underneath all of it, is the fact that the completely deregulated environment created a situation where the lowest price point was so low that it didn't allow for investment in hardening the infrastructure of the grid, which is why they didn't winterize the plants and the turbines, because the margins, the very, very low price competitive environment didn't allow for that. And that was a huge mistake. I mean, they've been bragging about how cheap it is to get electricity and get power in Texas for a long time. And that's because they weren't paying for the infrastructure that they need to keep the system up and running. So it's a really bad policy over a long period of time. And I think it should cause them to really reassess their approach to energy provision. And I agree with Judith. I think they should be looking at interconnecting with other states so that they don't have this this problem again. And I don't think that the FERC regulations are so onerous that they can't, that it's going to make it, you know, untenable for them to do. I think they just have to, you know, put on their grown-up pants and say, okay, we need to do this in a much more responsible and sustainable way.
And it absolutely right. And it is a failure of deregulation. So when some policymakers say we just should let the market take care of things, this is what you get. And a lot of this was also there was some power floating around in the beginning, but the price went from $23 a megawatt hour to $9,000 a megawatt hour. And they didn't want to pay that. So that's why they started the rolling blackouts. I think the rolling blackouts saved them from catastrophe. But again, not that this wasn't a catastrophe. Again, you know, this happened 10 years ago, not statewide, but there are very detailed recommendations on how to upgrade the electrical grid, and they ignored it.
Well, David, their process doesn't have. All right, hold on, Heather,
and then David, go ahead.
I was just going to say their process doesn't have the kind of standby power capacity right now. Like in New York, our grid has standby capacity, and there's a process by which generators are basically paid to stand at the ready to put more power into the market if there's a surge. And those are somewhat predictable because of weather patterns. They don't have that kind of capacity that we have. But I had a briefing yesterday on this, and if something like this had happened in New York, we don't have sufficient standby capacity in New York to accommodate the kind of increased load that they encountered in Texas. So we would have to have gone to outside markets. So the fact that we're interconnected would have saved us, right? They don't have that. So they had two tools at their disposal that they decided, or not at their disposal, that they needed under the circumstances. So there's just, you know, multiple layers of policy failures here.
What I love is what – oh, David Ghost, right? David,
go ahead, Alan, and then we'll go to David.
Well, let me just say that what I love is how each of these cretins, including the electric providers, are pointing and say, no, they did it. It was somebody else. We did good. We were ready to go. We stopped the rolling blackouts. We stopped this and that. Well, we did rolling blackouts. It's amazing how human beings will try to deflect criticism.
Mm-hmm. And not David, take responsibility. Ahead. Sorry, yeah. David. We keep stepping on David.
I want to go back to some of the original issues that we were talking about moments ago. Look, the reality is that if you are a red state and you have a Republican administration or a conservative administration, you're denying science right now. And if you're denying science right now, then you're not going to make investments that address the climate change issues that result from denying science. This is an issue that must now be adopted federally. And mm-hmm. I understand the reluctance of states, you know, giving up their authority to a giant federal government. But let's look at what gun laws have done in our country. Every state has its own policy, and this patchwork doesn't work. It just doesn't. And so if you're allowing, you know, Texas to operate, you know, independently, okay, that's fine. But when something happens, it's not Texas that's dealing with the issue. It's the rest of the country that has to rush in to provide aid and provide assistance. And that's the way it should be. So, you know, the environment isn't attacking or isn't impacting just Texas. It's not just impacting California. It's impacting the globe. And I'm glad that we're back in the Paris Agreement, climate agreement today. But it's attacking the globe, and it's attacking our country. And so our investments in infrastructure, you know, this infrastructure bill that hopefully one day we see, you know, it's got to be done where it's the federal government that is responsible for these investments, for these improvements, because at the end of the day, when something goes wrong, it is the federal government that's providing that response. So we need a more unified series of policies that impact every state regardless of ideology.
David Soares on the Roundtable panel on Friday, February 19th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. You may contact us by emailing roundtable@wamc.org. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.